Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm great, David. Thank you very much.
Before we dive into this week's topic, do you want to make an announcement about an upcoming live show?
Yes, we have a live show coming up on November 22nd as part of the Edinburgh History Festival. And the our event, we're going to be recording a live episode, so please come if you're local and you're interested to the French Institute, and it's at 7:45 on November 22nd, 7:45 to 8:45.
Which is a Friday night.
It's a Friday night. So the History Festival is a great institution, and they usually sponsor quite lively events, and so, you know, if you want to go for a drink first before the event and come and ask us questions, that would be great.
Yes, or afterwards, we are happy for both post, pre and post drinks, and during drinks probably as well.
And the History Festival is an annual event held every November, and they bring together public historians and academic historians like ourselves and members of the public to chat about history.
And the theme this year is about Scotland's connection or with France.
That's right.
And so we're going to be speaking not so much about Scotland's connection with France, but about the United States' connection with France in various ways. So we get to talk about the Louisiana Purchase and Freedom Fries and other kinds of
things. With that, but I hope we'll also take questions.
Bring any and all questions. Right. So for the past several years, President Trump has often decried the attacks upon him as witch hunts, a term he's used on Twitter more than 120.
The greatest witch hunt in American history.
The greatest witch hunt, which clearly it wasn't. And most recently, he's chosen another historical reference point to describe what he sees as an unfair political persecution, describing it as a lynching. So what we wanted to do today is sort of disentangle the sort of metaphorical historical allusions that Trump is relying upon, talk about the ways in which these terms have been used, both in their original historical context and then since then metaphorically. Right, so let's start off with the witch hunts, because that seems to be his preferred historical metaphor.
Yes, because he used lynching. He described the current impeachment hearings as a lynching for the first time two or three days ago. But he, as you say, he's used witch hunt in some way, shape, or form. So more than 100 times?
It's 120 times on Twitter, last time somebody counted,
Okay. And whenever he uses it, there's usually a backlash on Twitter from our friends in the profession saying, clearly this is wrong. And it is. Surely the greatest witch hunt in American history is actually the Salem witch hunt when 20 people were killed.
Yes.
although in President Trump's defense, as we'll see in the next few minutes, people have used witch hunt as a kind of metaphor for political persecution at other times. And so I think that notwithstanding his hyperbolic claims about it being the greatest witch hunt in American history, he may not mean, and I slightly hesitate to try and divine what he means.
Inside his head is hard.
He could be using that in the context of saying it's the greatest political witch hunt in American history.
Even that's a bit of a push.
Yes, it is. But I accept that. But as opposed to saying, well, no, in 1692 in Salem, you know, 19 people were hanged and one was crushed to death.
Yeah.
As a result, I mean, clearly that makes Salem the biggest witch hunt in American history. Apropos of witch hunts, I mean, the tradition of witch hunting goes back, of course, to European history, and it was brought to North America by European settlers. Almost every place where there were European settlers, there were witchcraft persecutions of some kind. These were especially pronounced in parts of colonial America, colonial British America, I should say, especially where Calvinism predominated, but not exclusively.
So we're talking then mostly New England.
We're talking mostly New England, but not only New England. I mean, there were witch hunts in Virginia. But there are occasional prosecutions, and historians seem quite clear, and we've got friends in the business who are experts in this, more expert than we are, but the literature seems to suggest that witch hunting was used as a way, even inadvertently, of social control, of trying to exercise control over deviants, and I'm not saying that in a pejorative way, but they're sort of threatening persons, often women, usually women, but not always, who kind of deviated from societal norms in some way. We don't really have to go into the history of witch hunting, is what's, I think, germane here is Trump's use of it, but it is important to remember there were witch hunts in America, especially in the colonial period. There aren't many. I don't think there are any in the 19th century.
Not in the way that they had in the colonial era.
No, I mean, they die out by about the mid-18th century.
Well, I think the Salem witch trials was not only sort of the biggest episode of this, but I think it sort of marks in some ways the there are witch trials afterwards, but I think there are fewer of them than there were beforehand. I think part of what they realized in Salem was the sort of the problematic nature of these kinds of persecutions.
That's right. I mean, I think kind of as a culture, colonial Americans took a step back and thought, whoa, what are we doing? Exactly. Let's not do that again.
Exactly.
And so there were periodic witch hunts in the 17th century or relatively small, not witch hunts so much as prosecutions and persecutions. A witch hunt is a kind of hysteria that results in widespread injustice, which is the way I think President Trump is using it. Is a reference, a direct reference, either consciously or unconsciously to Salem.
But before we get to the sort of metaphorical use, there are lots of theories about what actually happened in Salem, what prompted it, and historians have wrestled with that. Do you have a favorite theory about what actually happened, and do you have a favorite crazy theory about what actually happened?
Well, when I when I used to teach colonial America, and I still occasionally do, although my expertise and main interest is in the Revolutionary era, students would always write about this. And our friend and colleague and predecessor, Roderick Jeffries Jones, who was a modern American historian, used to tell me that he refused to let students write essays or dissertations on the Kennedy assassination.
Okay.
Because he just said, I'm tired of it. It gets too crazy. I can't stand the conspiracy theories. Yeah. And I kind of reached that position on the Salem witch trials because students would write essays, always wanted to write about it. Often they would write pretty good essays, but sometimes they would just write these bonkers essays. And so there's one theory about the bad wheat.
The rye went bad with a fungus or a bacteria or something to cause hallucinations. I love that one.
That's right.
It's nuts.
There's that one. And then there's, we don't have to get into the historiography of this. The Boyer and Nissenbaum thesis from the early 70s about basically economic anxiety and looking at where the accusers came from as opposed to those who were accused. That always seemed quite to make a lot of sense to me.
But that almost in some ways made the trials more about tensions between men than it was between tensions between women.
That's right. And John Demos wrote a lot about the gender demand, and others, Carol Carlson and others.
Mary Beth Norton wrote a book on it.
Yes, that's right. I mean, Norton's book talks about kind of anxiety about the French and Indians.
There had been a war on the main frontier that she talks about. So, I mean, we're as historians, they're still sort of wrestling with what happened at Salem.
Yeah, people are endlessly fascinated by this.
Because the sources are really interesting to read. Trial transcripts.
Yeah, I mean, Colonial New England is an interesting place to study because on one hand, it's such an alien culture to us. Mm. The names are familiar, the people seem familiar, but they live in a totally different world.
Yeah.
Yet, because of their literacy and their propensity to keep records, it's a very well-documented place in a way that, frankly, early Virginia is not.
Yeah,
to the same extent, or other parts of North America, and so it's well documented. And as you say, there are trial records, and everybody loves a trial. Everybody loves why is Law and Order so popular? and so there's that dimension to it. It's a fascinating story, and it's still difficult to explain why this culture, this relatively small community, killed 20 of its own. It's an interesting historical event.
Yeah.
In and of itself, the metaphor is interesting too. So I think we were chatting off air before we started, and one of the things we were perplexed by is whether the phrase witch hunt, to use in a political context, when that started. Yeah. And I'll talk about Jefferson in a moment. I always do.
No episodes without Jefferson. That's a promise, listeners.
Yes, exactly. That's it's our brand.
It's your brand.
Okay, fair enough. We'll get to the Civil War.
Okay.
But it seems that it really did enter the lexicon in a political context in the 1950s, in the context of the Red Scare, McCarthyism in particular, and the play The Crucible.
By Arthur Miller.
By Arthur Miller, which debuted in 1953. The McCarthy hearing, or McCarthy comes to the fore in 1950. So Miller seems to have written, he did write The Crucible in response to the persecution of communists and suspected communists in the United States in the 1950s. And after that, if only because seemingly every high school student in America has to read The Crucible.
Well, it's because it's a two-for-one. You get to talk about the colonial era and you get to talk about the 1950s simultaneously.
Exactly. And it's a great play. It's a really great play. So, and it teaches well. And anyway, because of that, I think it entered the lexicon in the way that President Trump has been using it and has persisted ever since. And that's... It kind of, one of the themes that's emerged as we've tried to disentangle President Trump's understanding of the past is, I think we've advanced a thesis over a number of episodes, that his worldview is really fixed in the 1950s in all kinds of ways. And I think this kind of reflects that as well.
Yes, I think so.
So I think, I just think that's interesting. Parenthetically and briefly, as we were trying to think of historical precedents for the use of witch hunting as a metaphor, in Jefferson, in response to the Alien and Sedition Acts adopted, and which we've talked about previously, in 1798 by the Federalists, talked about the reign of witches and talked about the persecution, the Federalist persecution of newspaper editors in 1798 and 99 as a reign of witches. The interesting thing there is, his use of the metaphor actually it doesn't quite work because the witches are the persecutors in that analysis. So whereas the way President Trump is using witch hunting, the way Arthur Miller uses it, and the way that we tend to use it, witches are people who are being persecuted and being persecuted unjustly.
Yeah, none of the witches in the Salem witch trial were guilty of anything.
How do you know?
Because witches are. Despite Halloween edition, you know, coming up in a week, there's no such thing as witchcraft. I'm a skeptic about the supernatural, but we can. I'm going to make the bold statement that the witches were not guilty of witchcraft.
Okay, I will accept your stipulation.
Okay, why did Arthur Miller pick that historical episode to criticize American politics in the early 1950s? What was it about the similarities between the Second Red Scare and the Salem witch trials that he said, okay, right, this is what I'm going to use to talk about the contemporary moment?
Well, I think more or less for the reasons we alluded to earlier. I mean, for the same reason that students like to write essays about it and our colleagues like to write books about it. It's a fascinating story as a drama. And again, as I said a couple of minutes ago, people like legal dramas.
To be sure.
And there is a legal drama there. And it's very, very... Well, he's a dramatist. It's very dramatic. And people are drawn to stories of injustice. Mm. And by using the past as his vehicle... Yeah. You know, if Miller had written... And it's not a very subtle...
Yeah, no, it's not.
play in that regard. It's clearly about McCarthyism. But if Miller had written a play about McCarthyism, it might not have been as compelling, and it might have gotten him into trouble. Writing about this historic injustice is both safe and subversive at the same time.
Right. And well, I think one of the things about that links them, I think that's the reason why it works so well as a metaphor, is that the Salem witch trials relied upon things like spectral evidence. Right, and the accusation of being a witch was kind of in itself condemning, right? The you couldn't really defend yourself for saying you weren't a witch if somebody accused you of witchcraft.
Yes, the 20th person killed in Salem, Giles Corey, the one who's not hanged,
yes,
is crushed to death for refusing to enter a plea.
Yeah.
So it's clearly not a fair process if simply by refusing to... Basically, he said, I'm not going to participate in this process.
Yeah. You can't say you're not... Because if you say you're not a witch, then they say, but these women say you are a witch, and therefore you're guilty, and course, if you are a witch, the thing you would say is you're not a witch. And, right. And so, likewise, if you are accused of being a communist, how are you going to prove that you're not a communist? It's about sort of evidence of crimes that are not visible.
And much of that evidence, if you're also, if you're not accepting witchcraft, David, I assume you're also not accepting the validity of spectral evidence.
Yeah, no, spectral evidence is not admissible in my court.
Okay, fair enough. Again, I think we're on the same page on that. But it also means that people are convicted by innuendo and whisper and rumor and all things right. like, and that happens in both cases. But, I mean, the one thing, and we this just came to me as you were speaking about the spectral evidence. Mm. We had a very interesting variation on Trump's use of witch hunt in the past couple of weeks, which was when Rudy Giuliani came out and declared that the Salem witchcraft trials had a higher standard of evidence, I think, or some words to that effect, than the impeachment hearing. So he brought these two things together, and he got lambasted on social media and other media for this. I just want to say that for as long as this very interesting moment continues and we're in this we're suffering as we are, I hope Rudy Giuliani never stops talking or tweeting.
Yes,
because, well, just because
but you know, if this is the world we live in, I think we should reintroduce spectral evidence. I think we can punish our enemies in all kinds of ways if that's the new legal standard.
So Rudy actually took Trump's Giuliani took Trump's use of this metaphor and actually kind of took it literally and took ran it to another step and ran with it in an interesting way.
Now, you know, in the context of the 1950s when McCarthy is writing The Crucible to critique the Second Red Scare, the House Un-American Activities Committee, McCarthyism, what have you, to be sure, there are lots of people who were persecuted who were unjustly, but there was also actually a real threat then by the Soviet Union.
There were Soviet agents in the United States?
As opposed to, like, actual witches in Salem, you know.
Right, although, sorry, kidding aside, we have to, this is back to where 17th century New England is both, is fascinating and accessible because they use our language, but it's also incredibly different.
Yeah. They thought that witches.
They believed that witches were as great a danger to them as some people in the 1950s believed that the communists were.
To be sure. Yes. Yes.
So you know,
the reality of witches were they were as real as the sun or the moon.
That's right. That's right. And I think, again, in teaching this topic, you have to get students to accept that, so that they're not just sort of...
Yeah, these people aren't just crazy people. They're rationally acting from these premises.
Right,
yeah.
The conceit of the present and judging the past. So you have to understand that intelligent people could credibly believe this.
Yes, yes. Now, it's striking that, you know, using this metaphor, that you know, when it was used in the context of the Salem witch trials or used in the context of the 1950s, it was usually powerless people being attacked by powerful people, and either, you know, executed or blacklisted or imprisoned or what have you.
Well, it's even more fundamental than that, David. It's the force of the state, whatever the state was being used against, as you say, powerless or relatively powerless individuals.
Whereas, you know, in Trump's case,
he's the head of state.
Exactly. So it seems very. It seems like a very odd usage. Why is it you think he's latched on? Trump has latched on to this particular metaphor, other than he grew up in the '50s and that was a terminology that seems resonant with
him. Well, a couple of things. I mean, this state versus non-state thing is interesting. I think on one hand we can just laugh and say, well, it's another thing he's got wrong.
Mm.
On the other, he's never really accepted the kind of authority of the U.S. state or its authority to judge him.
Mm-hmm.
And to some extent, he ran as an outsider. His supporters see him as an outsider who tells it like it is, you know, draining the swamp, I'm taking on the deep state, all this kind of thing. And so to some extent, despite the fact he is literally the head of state of the United States.
Yeah, the most powerful man in the world.
Notionally.
Yes.
that he still sees himself as a victim of the state. So to some extent, I think we may think this doesn't work, this metaphor in this case. He thinks it does. Now, I don't think he's necessarily interpreting it on this level of detail, but I think he would see himself as a victim at the hands of the state, being unjustly accused.
Yeah, and I think his followers, I think, buy into that.
That's
that
right.
Vision of him, his political place.
Now, I don't think that he... Well, I think he's broken the law. I think we have abundant evidence to that effect. I'm not entirely sure he knows he's broken the law. Or that he, you know, I mean, I think there's an interesting, I mean, his defense of the Ukrainian phone call is very interesting. And so in that sense, he thinks he's being persecuted for something that isn't wrong.
Yes,
which,
I think
which the witch hunt, the witch hunt metaphor works for that. We may not accept that. Again, I think just as we don't accept that the people in Salem were witches, I don't think we accept that Donald Trump is a victim of a witch.
Maybe not exactly in the same way, but I think we have yes.
But I think that in response to your question of why is it this appeals to him, I think he believes he's a victim. It is interesting because historically witch hunts, of course, the victims of witch hunts have been often marginalized women.
Yes, at least in the original case, yes.
In the original case, and yeah, that's right. And so it doesn't work on that score.
No.
But I think it does reflect the fact that he doesn't see his role in the American state as others do, and that he really does feel he's being persecuted. And as you said, this is important, you know, one of the things that Trump does expertly, even if unintentionally, is he's a very good communicator in terms of communicating certain messages to his supporters.
Yes.
You know, and we might laugh at his syntax and cringe, as we'll get to lynching in a moment, at some of the, but in repeating things over and over, the message that's going to his supporters is, you know, I'm being persecuted, this is a witch hunt. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what the polling looks like on this, and I, you know, we'll see this play out in the next few months, I guess, is the degree to which that's taken root. I think among his supporters, it's quite powerful.
Yeah, I think it's...
And it's a simple metaphor.
Well, and I think it helps to delegitimize all of the... anything that comes up, all the investigations, whether they're in the House or other places. It's by labeling it preemptively as a witch hunt, anything the Democrats uncover will be dismissed by Trump and his followers as being sort of part of this, you know, conspiracy against him.
That's right. And witch hunters by definition are bad.
Yes.
Except in the Jefferson use of the metaphor, where the witches are actually the persecutors, and therefore theoretically the people...
We should hunt. Yeah, we should. Yeah, okay.
But anyway, let's leave that aside.
Let's go to talk about this very bizarre comment on lynching that he has introduced into this discourse, which he did a couple of days ago. What was your reaction to his use of the word lynching?
I cringed. Well, I mean, because it was cringeworthy. And I was about to write a tweet about the number of people who've been lynched, and a million historians did that, so I didn't need to. And historians were expert in that field, more expert than I am. And so, you know, so I went and I thought, oh, you're kidding me. A lot of people think that what he does is calculated, intended to distract. And I don't tend to subscribe to that, although we ended up having a discussion about lynching that day. God, it's hard to keep track of. Was that the same day that the Republicans tried to occupy the hearing room, or was it the day before?
It was the day before that. And they didn't try to occupy, they did occupy.
No, I understand. Yeah. Well, they temporarily, it wasn't really an occupation. It was anyway, but that's a...
They ordered pizza.
So the day he made that tweet with reference to lynching was the day that Bill Taylor, is that his name?
Yes.
Was testifying, which is the most damning testimony thus far, it seems, from the news reports. Mm-hmm. And so one reading of this would be, he did this deliberately to
distract
and, you know, own the libs and all this kind of thing. And arguably it worked.
Wag the dog.
Arguably it worked, although it was so horrendous, or it seemed so inappropriate. Look, people might have, it's impossible not to feel sympathy if you read any of the accounts of the Salem witch trials for those who were accused and to think that an injustice was done. But
lynching's an order of magnitude.
It was 300 years ago. Okay. It was 300 years ago. Lynching is an order of magnitude worse, in part because far more people were lynched than were ever accused and executed because of witchcraft. And lynching has some of the characteristics of witch hunting in the sense that there's often a kind of faux legal apparatus around it. But lynching is just an order of magnitude worse. And given the racial dimension to lynching historically, not everyone who was lynched was black in the United States, but the vast majority of people who were lynched were black or were perceived as either being threatening others of some way, either or allies of African Americans, for example. So, given the racial context and given Trump's own racial history and the history of his administration, this seems especially problematic.
So, I mean, you mentioned the numbers, and there have been various groups that have tried to calculate how many Americans were lynched during the sort of apex of racial violence. Both the Tuskegee Institute and the NAACP kept records trying to sort of enumerate how many lynchings there were as part of a campaign to get a federal anti-lynch law. And it's, something the order of 4,000 people were lynched, the vast majority of whom were African Americans.
And that's a minimum problem.
That's the ones they can document, right? And the thing about lynching that it was, for those of you who haven't, listeners who haven't had a chance to study lynching, lynching is a form of racial terrorism in the way that it functioned. Lynchings were, many of them, public spectacle events, well attended by hundreds of people, and it wasn't just often an execution, it was execution coupled with systematic torture of dismemberment, of burning, of castration, of all kinds of methods of
and often photographed.
Oh, yeah, these were
spectacles.
They ran special trains occasionally to for people to attend lynchings, and so these were not, to be sure, many lynchings were also done in the dead of night, but many lynchings were done in full daylight in the town square. People are taking pictures, and people were happy to be identified in the pictures.
The people posing in front of the victims.
And these were things that were sold as postcards that you could buy in stores in the South. The people who were in those pictures, people who were conducting the violence, knew that they could engage in this kind of violence without any fear of legal ramifications. This is not just people in hoods, these are people who are, wearing their Sunday best to go to a lynching as a
we have to return to lynching, but I think there's an interesting distinction to be drawn, therefore, between witch hunts and lynchings in the sense that witch hunts, as we discussed earlier, are the state using its power to and go through a judicial process and to persecute, but it's state power, whereas lynching tends to be extra legal.
Yeah, lynching by definition is extra legal, but the ways in which the state was often complicit in lynching was profound. I mean, there were many cases of African Americans who were accused of crimes, and then the mob would say, look, waiting for the judicial processes to take place, that was too slow, and that we needed to take a more immediate action. And police officers and judges would leave the jail unlocked for the mob to come in and grab people and execute them right outside of the jail. And so there's a way in which it was sort of extra legal in terms of but it was also condoned and by politicians and legal authorities.
Sure. No, I understand that. But I think that distinction is important because I think it there's a subtle difference and again, I'm not sure President Trump is thinking on these lines, but if the impeachment hearings are a witch hunt, then it's the deep state coming to get him in the way we talked about before. It's I'm a victim of the state. If it's a lynching or a political lynching, metaphorical lynching, then it's totally illegal in his mind. And he's thinking, you know, in other words, Adam Schiff is the head of a lynch mob. Mm-hmm. He's not even the sheriff now. He's the, you know, or he's not even the judge. You know, he's not the judge in a witchcraft trial. Instead, he's committing judicial murder.
Yes. The thing that struck me, you know, and we can forgive Trump's ignorance if that's permissible, but the person who should know better is Lindsey Graham, who, after Trump said it's a lynching, people asked him, do you think this is a lynching? Trump said it's a lynching. And Lindsey Graham said yes, he thinks it's a lynching.
So why do you think Lindsey Graham
should know better? Well, because Lindsey Graham's from South Carolina, and he's, you know...
And he's not young.
He's not young. Like, he wasn't around, wasn't alive when lynching was ubiquitous, but his parents were, you know, so he is, you know, not that far removed from lynching, in terms of his own personal experience. You know, is he in Strom Thurmond's seat? I think he's might be in Strom Thurmond's seat. If he's not, he's in the other one. You know, South Carolina was the site of at least 185 of these lynchings, and so, you know, it is embedded in you know, Trump's from New York and what have you know, so he doesn't maybe know about the history of lynching. Lindsey Graham should, and he should know that because the Senate has voted twice to condemn historical lynchings while he was in the Senate, and he voted for, they were both unanimous votes, and he voted for it both times for condemning lynching. So, you know, he...
So he's literally on the record.
He's on the record as saying lynching is bad, and that you know, lynching is a historical crime to which the United States was culpable for both its actions and inactions. You know, he can't pretend not to know that the word lynch has all of these, has this history to it.
Okay, I've got a response to that. I actually want to play devil's advocate.
Oh, you're going to defend Lindsey Graham.
No, okay, good. But before I do that, I think it might be helpful for our listeners if you can talk about the history of the word lynch and lynching, because there's a bit of a debate about this, isn't there?
There are five or six origin stories for where this term comes from. Some of these origin stories trace it back to Ireland in the early modern period. Most linguists now think that the word lynch actually derives from one of two guys named Lynch who are in Virginia at the end of the 18th century who are engaged in extra-legal violence against African-Americans. And so it seems from the very beginning, at least in its American usage, and its American usage is where it's most ubiquitous, when people use the word lynch, there's a very clear racial connotation to it, going back to the antebellum period. And obviously, you know, throughout the late 19th and early 20th century, when we have this sort of epidemic of lynchings in the American South, it is, you know, very clear that the word lynch has to do with racial violence perpetrated by white people against African Americans as the sort of default model of what it is. To be sure, there are lots of other people who are lynched too, but of the records we have, the overwhelming number of people who are lynched are African Americans, who, and this is also worth pointing out, thinking about the way in which it gets used, you know, white Southerners justified lynching, saying that the people they were lynching were criminals. Very often they used claims of sexual violence against white women as the justification for lynching, and both African Americans at the time and historians since then have documented how these claims that lynching victims were in fact guilty of things those are fictions, right? And probably the most famous of the sort of debunkers of this notion of black criminality at the time was Ida B. Wells, who wrote a series of newspaper articles and a couple of books, including Southern Horrors in 1892 and The Red Record in 1895, where she chronicles not only how many lynchings were committed, but the ways in which the pretenses for lynchings were often fabricated or trivial. And, you know, thinking about one of these sort of later examples of lynching that's also been in the news this week, probably the most famous lynching from the 1950s, the lynching of Emmett Till, right. Who, you know, was a boy who was lynched supposedly for whistling at a white woman. And we now know from work by historian Tim Tyson that the woman who was supposedly whistled at fabricated that story that led to his murder. And the reason why Emmett Till's been in the news this week is that the historical marker to for locating the site of his murder has been replaced for the fourth time. The three previous markers were either stolen or shot to the point of being unrecognizable, much in the same way that Emmett Till was killed and made almost unrecognizable. And they made the new one steel to make it, and sort of bulletproof somehow, to make it, because I think they believe it's going to be vandalized again, or people will try to.
Yes, and I mean, unfortunately, when I read that story, I thought, oh, well, if you make it bulletproof, that's the people who want to vandalize it will see that as a challenge.
Yes.
Right, and I in no way want to downplay the horror of lynching in any way. Mm. So I want to make, I'm going to choose my words carefully for the next couple of minutes. But to give President Trump the benefit of the doubt, when he uses these, and I want to stipulate as well, I think the impeachment hearings are totally legitimate and are investigating things and they're following due process, and so I don't think there are issues with that. However, when he lashes out in this way or defends himself, and he employs these two metaphors, witch hunting much more frequently and more recently now lynching, he's not unusual in the sense that politicians, and one of the things that happened this week is we had a lot of evidence from the Clinton impeachment of
yes.
Democrats using lynching as a metaphor for what happened to Bill Clinton.
Including Joe Biden.
Including Joe Biden. So I guess what I'm going to say is, let's set aside Trumpian hyperbole and Trump's historical ignorance. Those are two important qualifiers. And just say, you know, people, politicians use this language. They use metaphors all the time. These metaphors, as we've just demonstrated over the past few minutes, have a long lineage in terms of how they're used by politicians. Mm-hmm. And therefore, maybe we shouldn't get so head up about it.
Well, one thing, though, thinking back, I mean, people have uncovered these various references to people using the word lynch in reference to the Clinton impeachment. Even though that wasn't that long ago, I think we're in a different place historically now with our conversation about racial violence and lynching than we were then.
Right, I agree. I don't think Joe Biden would use that language, no. Not just because he's running for president.
And he apologized for using
right,
it. So,
right.
You know, and I think that should be sort of, the United States right now is in a moment where it is in some ways trying to wrestle with this legacy of lynching and other forms of racial violence in a way that it chose not to for very many years. You know, right now I have a national monument to peace and justice in Montgomery, Alabama, where they have, which is essentially a monument to the history of lynching and trying to sort of reconstruct this lost memory. We, the Americans, in trying to tell the story of African American history, you know, often sort of skip over a large section of the late 19th and early 20th century because it is so deeply unpleasant. You know, when we teach American history to young people, we, you know, talk a great deal about the Civil Rights Movement. But we don't talk about the decades that preceded it very much because it's such a deeply uncomfortable and traumatizing story. And I think it's only been in the past decade or so that many Americans, and especially things like museums, have come to grips with how to tell those kinds of stories. I was struck in particular by the in Greensboro, North Carolina, they've got a museum at the what used to be the Woolworths, where one of the first sit-ins
right.
was held in 1960. And before they get to the story of the sit-ins and the consequences thereof, they have, when you go to the museum there today, they have a very lengthy section, you know, where they talk about the history of racial violence in the late 19th and early 20th century. They show you pictures of lynchings. They make you understand the consequences of, you know, what those four young men were doing when they sat in at the lunch counter. You know, people have all seen the pictures of people doing sit-ins having milkshakes poured on their heads. That's not what they were worried about. When the people talk about Rosa Parks, they say, oh, she was arrested. Getting arrested is not what she was worried about.
As you demonstrated, your problem started after you were arrested.
Exactly.
You were in custody and you could be dragged out of jail.
Yeah, and the fear of violence, you know, was, you know, if we think about these 4,000 lynchings, the way to think about these is, you know, not only for the victims, but for the entire communities of people who are terrorized by lynching. All the sort of choices that aren't made during those decades because of the profound fear that African Americans had of violating the rules imposed upon them by white Southerners about what would happen if they, you know, challenged the racial hierarchy.
So is it, then, you know, I agree with all of that, but so, but in response to my comment that politicians have used this language, I agree with you. I don't think politicians would resort to the language of lynching today as commonly as they have in the past.
Yeah, right.
I think that's quite right. And even though the Clinton impeachment was 20 years ago, 20 years is a long time, and attitudes have changed. So I suspect you're right about that. So would we make a distinction? Is it okay to use witch hunt as a metaphor, but not lynching? You may not agree that Trump is a victim of witch hunt, but
the thing about both of them is, you know, the victims of witch hunts are marginalized women. The victims of lynching are marginalized African Americans. I think if we use these terms, we should talk about them in the context of marginalized people being victimized, not wealthy, powerful white guys being held to account for their, you know.
But you kind of, with respect, I think you're missing my point. Trump doesn't feel that he's being held to account. Yeah. He feels he's being persecuted.
If you're a
powerful white man, can you not use a metaphor to describe your persecution? Or what metaphor can you use? I mean,
the fact that there isn't a metaphor is historically, you know, interesting, right?
Well,
there's
the Inquisition.
Okay, Trump, you can use the Inquisition if you're listening.
I think this is a real point, David. I think you're
the Galileo.
I think, you know, so can you not, you know, are there no metaphors?
Well, I think all metaphors are limited in their applicability. But metaphors that are so charged like these ones are, and I think lynching is far more charged
it's interesting he's only used lynching once thus far. I think the resonance of witch hunting is not nearly as powerful.
Yes.
I don't think it's as problematic as using lynching.
Yes, no, I think without a doubt you're right. Yeah, there are people lynching as a phenomenon didn't die out. And obviously people are still lynched today, just not frequently.
One of the reasons it's so problematic.
As a widespread phenomenon, it wasn't that long ago. At its apex.
And we're living in a culture where racial violence is still a problem.
On all kinds of levels. In fact, there are ways in which you could talk about various kinds of violence portrayed now as kinds of lynchings. The other example of, besides the Clinton impeachment, where lynching was used in a political context in the recent past, relatively speaking, is in the Clarence Thomas hearings.
Nearly 30 years
which
ago.
Which is near, okay, so...
1991, but...
Okay, so I'm using recent as in I can remember it happening.
Well, and that was interesting on a number of levels, particularly in the way we now look back at it, because, of course, as many listeners will know, but for those who don't, Clarence Thomas, when he was nominated for the Supreme Court, Anita Hill, who had been one of his clerks and was a staffer, accused him of sexual harassment. And both were African-American, or both are African-American, I should say. And Clarence Thomas claimed that his hearing about this, which had some resonances with the Kavanaugh hearings last year, although he comported him, I can't believe I'm saying this, comported himself with much more dignity. It's relative.
Yes, relative.
but Thomas described his hearings, his confirmation hearings, as a high-tech lynching. And given that Thomas is African-American and employed this metaphor, it made people say, ooh, you know, I mean, I guess you a few minutes ago when I said, okay, can politicians use any of these metaphors, said, well, powerful white men shouldn't. What about African-Americans?
I think one would be safer, and, you know, I'm just steering away from lynching generally, but Clarence Thomas's usages of it are interesting in as much as lynching, of course, was always connected to, or was often connected to, claims that African-American men are sexually violent, right? And so that so there was the sexual element of lynching that was embedded within Clarence Thomas's comments. The people who were on the Judiciary Committee, both listening to Anita Hill and listening to Clarence Thomas, were, I think they were all white men, including Joe Biden. Joe Biden shows up. The man's been
around for a long time.
I mean, the man first ran for president in
1987.
88, yeah, 87. 07 is when he got so a long time. The 30th anniversary of his, you know, and so I think there was sort of the racial dynamic in that particular discourse, but there's also the gender dynamic happening that made that a very interesting moment politically, and therefore Clarence Thomas's usage of that term particularly charged. I think politicians, if they would be wise, to excise the word lynch from their vocabulary.
Well, frankly, I think everybody should, unless we're actually talking about historical lynching. Phenomenon. No,
lynching, yes.
Witch hunting is just less charged because it's less immediate. In the same way, one can talk about the Inquisition and think, oh, well, that was a terrible injustice in the past, but it doesn't have the same.
You can have the Monty Python skit about
right,
it.
And right, okay. Precisely.
All right. Time for last drops, Frank. What you got?
Right. Well, I want to promote some events we're holding, an event we're holding in New York City on, by we, I mean the University of Edinburgh, on the 11th of November, which is Veterans Day. On the 11th of November at the Penn Club, and we'll put the details up, the university is holding a reception and a panel and a reception to celebrate the 300th anniversary of the appointment of the first professor of history at the university. Charles Mackey was appointed professor of universal history in 1719.
Yes.
And we had an event this week, reception.
Very exciting.
With the chancellor of the university.
Got a plaque.
Yeah, to commemorate this. And we're going to have a panel in New York on followed by a reception discussing really what is history relevant in this contemporary moment. You know, we're living in a moment of incredibly rapid change, political and technological, and there's a lot going on, and we're going to discuss the role of history in all this. And participating are going to be, well, I'm going to be there. Our head of school, Ewan Cameron, is going to chair this panel, and the other participants are our colleague Gail Davis from Economic and Social History, Joanne Freeman, the Fennell Lecturer from Yale University, who's from Yale, but she was this year's Fennell Lecturer here at the University of Edinburgh, and Bina Hansa, who's one of our former students, who's got a PhD at Vanderbilt University. So we've got alumni, we have friends of the university, and we were inviting all and sundry to come and hear this panel discussion on the role of history, and it'll be followed by a reception to which you're invited.
Excellent. So if you're in the New York area on, you said the 11th and 12th?
No, the 11th of November is the panel, okay. At 5 o'clock. But we've got some other things going on. We're doing other things to promote history, but that's the public event.
Excellent, and, okay.
You're welcome to it.
Wonderful. Yep. Okay.
And we can put the Eventbrite link on.
I'll put a link on the show page so people can get tickets.
Yep. What about you, David? What do you have?
Well, I got a somber note, but I think it's something that's worth looking at in thinking about our conversation today about lynching. Obviously, there's a huge amount of scholarly work on lynching that people could look at. There's a great book by Amy Wood on lynching. There's a great book by Fitz Brundage on lynching. There's some works by Bruce Baker and some other people on lynching. They're all Crystal Feimster. But I want to endorse a book and a website on lynching called Without Sanctuary, which is a compendium of lynching photos and the stories behind the lynching photos, as we mentioned in our discussion. You know, this the spectacle lynching of the late 19th and early 20th century were these events that were attended by hundreds, sometimes thousands of people, and they are, you know, very well documented by the participants. And so this collection of photos, if you want to understand the history of racial violence in the United States, if you want to understand the African-American experience both at the end of the 19th and early part of the 20th century, but also to understand the sort of origins of the civil rights movement, understanding what lynching was and taking a look at these photos, which are very hard to look at, I think is something though that people need to do, because it's an episode in American history that lots of Americans want to forget, but I think especially at this particular moment is something worth remembering.
Right.
So on that really somber note.
Yes.
Until next week.
Yep.
Cheers.
Next week, David.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at WhiskeyRebelPod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.